Good afternoon. I expect to have exam grades and life grades released tomorrow. And if you're wondering, yes, I thought that exam was longer than I wanted it to be. In retrospect, I probably should have had one less question. As you could see, there are some questions I asked which we hadn't asked questions like that before, so it's harder to calibrate how long it's actually going to take people. Anyways, so before the exam, way back when no one remembers anything, we briefly talked about message passing and went through how page table structure works. We talked about tricks with page fault handlers. This idea that because the processor triggers an exception when a page table entry doesn't let something happen, that we as OS writers can take advantage of this to do just-in-time correction of the page table entry that's bad. So, for example, we had allocate on demand. Rather than allocating all the memory in advance and setting up all the page tables, we just wait until the program tries to use a page table we haven't set up yet, and we know that that's not going to do something random. It's going to trigger a page fault exception that's going to go to our exception handler code, and we can say, okay, did I mean to allocate this? If the answer is yes, let's do it now for what you just tried to access and return, and when we return, we'll retry that access, and now it will work. We had another version of this trick for copy and write, that rather than copying the value, we're going to say, well, I don't really want to copy it, so I'll just mark everything as read-only. And, well, that means that if the program tries to write to it, it's not something random is going to happen, we're going to get a fault from the processor. So we say, did this happen because I marked it as read-only? If so, then let's actually make the copy now and return, and now everything should be fine. And these two tasks are what our upcoming homework is. It has a checkpoint which is due on Wednesday, because Wednesday is the day after the exam to start. I pondered like various other options. I figured having it due on a class day would be less good, and I wanted to like roughly half divide up the time you had to do the assignment. And probably the first part people usually find more straightforward, even though there's now an extra task this semester of dump page table. But hopefully that's mostly helpful. So I should mention, last semester, the version of this assignment had you implement allocated demand on copy and write and nothing else. This semester, you have to implement a system call to print out the contents of a page table. My hope is that you use that system call to debug what you're doing, rather than the typical debugging technique I saw last semester of printing here one, here two, and here three, and hoping you could figure out what's going on. Also, I'd note that when you're implementing allocate demand and copy and write, this changes how like malloc works for allocate on demand and how fork works for copy and write. Both of these are things the shell uses. So you are not unlikely to break the XV6 shell. This is why we supply test cases which can run replacing init. And I would recommend starting there when you have bugs, because you're likely to make the shell do weird things. And if that happens, go to the strategy of writing these small test cases which don't run the shell at all to avoid that. So any questions about anything from last time? Okay. So, just a note, for implementing copy on write, you're going to have to look at, well, you set some pages as read-only. The first part of copy on write is you set pages as read-only instead of copying them. Then, you're going to have to say, okay, a program tried to write a forbidden page, and you need to try to write something, and you need to figure out, this is cases for in the page fault for read-only case, right? You detect there's a page fault because the page was read-only. So one case is the program is trying to write to the kernel memory. If you implement your copy and write so you make that work, that's bad, right? You aren't supposed to let the program suddenly write to the kernel space. It can break things now that it's not supposed to be able to break. Otherwise, you can say, it was trying to write to a read-only page, and there's only one page table entry referencing it, then we can actually do this trick of skipping the copy. We can just say, well, if there's only one copy, I can just make it writable and not use it. If there are multiple, you have to actually make a copy. Another alternative would be you could instead copy it, delete original, and return from fault. So this is fine for the assignment. Probably you wouldn't want to do it in a real OS. Always copy, but delete the original when it goes away, when it's the last, when you runs out of things referring to it. Okay, so talked about that. So now I'm going to talk about, speaking of tricks we can do with page tables, a really weird trick that POSIX systems implement known as memmap. So there's this function which maps a file to memory. So you open a file descriptor, you get some data that represents that file as a pointer, and you can read from it and write to it. And when you write to it, it modifies the file. When you read from it, it reads the file. Did I talk on this last time? Maybe not. Okay. So this is the mmap prototype. So we have an address, a length, something called prot for protection flags, flags, which are other flags, a file descriptor, and an offset. And it returns the address it maps. So I'll start with the more obvious thing. So length is how much stuff to get from the file. So load that part of the file into my program's memory. And the protection flags are, that's the length, the file descriptor, and offset. And the protection flags are, should it be readable, writable, or executable? You can also specify none for just give me memory that seg faults all the time, which doesn't seem very useful, but like address sanitizer uses it, you know, to make memory that causes a seg, forces a seg fault. So we have that. Then we have flags. So flags, we have two options. We have map shared. Map shared says, hey, I want, when I change the thing you put in my memory, it should change the file. And you might be asking, how does that happen? How is it the case that I write to something and it changes a file that's stored on disk? We're going to talk about that. The other option is map private. And that gives you a copy of the data in the file. And in most POSIX systems, that's going to use copy on write. So if you try to write to it, it's going to make a copy of that page for you. There's also some additional flags. The most common one you might see is one called map anonymous, which is not in POSIX, but it is in Linux and a whole bunch of other things. And what it says is, ignore the file descriptor, just give me a memory. So this is also a memory allocation function, sort of analogous to malloc. And you might wonder, well, what's this address? The address is a suggestion about where you should put the mapping. It's a suggestion. It might be ignored. And most commonly, you'll see null passed, meaning choose for me. I don't care. Just put it anywhere in my memory. So you might say, OK, this is an interesting thing. So is this actually used? So you can think of mmap, the sort of memory region this creates. That's how Linux happens to manage a program's memory. So there's a special file in /proc, which dump information about a process. So here, proc self is the process that's reading this file. And maps is a list of all the mmaps set up for a process. And this is how Linux tracks what memory have I given to a process. So we have a list of these things, and this seems really opaque, partly because this special file that the kernel exports to tell me about the process doesn't have any headers. So there's some fields in here, but what are they? So I'll go through them. So first, we have the virtual address that the mapping was assigned. So if we called mmap, this is the virtual address it returned plus the length. Okay. So here we're saying that the program I'm running has something mapped at address 40000 hex to 40b000 hex. And we notice that this is a nice round number. That's because we only map whole pages. So if you call mmap with a length that's not a multiple of a page, the kernel's going to round for you. And why do we only map whole pages? Because that's all we can set in the page table. Then we have the settings. So here, this says it's a readable mapping. It's not writable. That's why there's a dash instead of a W. It's executable. And it's private, meaning it's copy on write if it was writable. Since it's not writable, this doesn't do anything. You might say, OK, why does this program have bin cat loaded at address 400000 as readable and executable? Well, it's because the program that's doing this is bin cat, and we had to load its code. And when Linux executes a program, it effectively turns that into a bunch of mmap calls to load the executable. So just like you called mmap a bunch of times to put the code in the memory. And here it says this is offset 0, so starting at the beginning of the executable bin cat. That's what's loaded into that memory. We also have this information here. This is another way of saying what file it is without the file name. This is more raw information. We'll talk about what this means when we talk about file systems. But all this is another way of identifying the file. So this is equivalent to as if we did an open call an mmap call. And this is done automatically when you execute bin cat. And we have a whole bunch of these. So we also have another mapping that's read-only. We have something that's read-write and copy-on-write. And these are from later areas of the file. We'll step through some more of these. So how does these read-only mappings work? And I'm going to talk about one way of implementing them. We could be more eager. But the simplest thing to do is you call mmap. And what should the kernel do to your page table? You might say, well, it should set all those pages up. But we're going to be lazy. We're going to choose the simplest thing right now, which maybe not isn't the simplest thing overall. And we're going to just not set any page table entries. We're just going to remember, yep, you have that file mapped in your memory. Good, I did it. Don't worry about it. Then the program is going to try to access some of this memory. And we'll get a page fault. And when that page fault happens, we're going to look up this table. So this is going to be stored in our process control block. There's going to be like an array of these. We'll look up and say, well, you had a page fault on page 2 of this mapping. What does that mean? And I look up, oh, it goes to bin cat. So I'm going to need to read bin cat to do that. And we're going to keep around information about where do we have that file loaded into memory. So in this case, I'm saying I access page 2 of this, and we happen to already have it in memory. We had it cached in memory for some reason. We'll talk about when we would cache things in memory later. We had it cached in memory. So I'm going to find that cache page, update the page table, and retry the access. And it's going to work. It's going to be a little bit slow because we had to update the page table. We're going to get access. Now, the program could also try to read from something which isn't mapped. We'll get a page fault, and we'll try to look up where can I read this file, and we'll find out, well, we don't have a cache copy. We didn't read it from the disk yet. That's fine. So we'll read it from the disk. That might take a while, but that's okay. We'll run something else while that's happening. And when we're finished reading it from the disk, we'll update, load it into our cache data for the file, and then update the page table entry to point to it and return from our page fault handler. Okay, so questions about this procedure? So the idea here is we have cached versions of the file that we keep around for every file, and we just make sure we point to them based on how mmap has been called previously. Just remember that information and update to point to those cache versions later. And if we remove something from the cache, we're going to remove it from this table. And we can reload it from disk later, so that's fine. Remove it from the page table, too. So that's read-only mappings. So I mentioned we could have shared mappings that write files. So here's an example of how that might appear. So I call mmap here, and I get a mapping at this address to this address, which is readable, writable, and shared, starting at offset 0 of some file dot dot. And that works basically the same way, except now I can write to it. So if I write to a page, I just update the cache data. Now there's a tricky thing here, which is that the operating system needs to know that I wrote to that, because if I don't do that, then I'm going to update the cached version, but I won't update the thing on disk. So we need to somehow track that the data is out of date. But we're going to update the cache file data, and sometime later, when we want to free the memory, we're going to have to write that back to disk. But the reason why when I write to the memory it's going to update the file is, even though I'm not writing to disk right away, is that if I try to read the file, the way the operating system is going to read the file is going to say, do I have a cached copy of this file? And if the answer is yes, well, it's going to say, okay, here it is. Here's my cached copy of the file. So I'll read what I wrote to that memory right away, because we're writing to the same version the kernel uses to read the file. But there's this tricky thing that we need to figure out, that it was updated, and remember to write it back to disk so the modifications persist if we free the memory up eventually. So questions about this procedure? So you may notice we're going to have some mechanism to determine whether pages are what we'll call dirty, meaning have been modified. We'll talk about options for that sometime later. So I also have private mappings. So you can see here in my bincat program, I have some space from bincat, which is mapped readable, writable, but private, meaning copy and write. Let's say, so why did bincat do this? Can someone give me an idea? Why would we load part of it copy and write? What is that data? Yeah? Everything that remains when it was forked? So not quite, because this is the case even though I forked and then exec bincat. And this is part of the bincat file. So some part of the actual executable that we want copy on write. So what information would be in an executable that we want to load that way? That we want to load the value, but we want to modify it and not change the executable, original executable. So what most likely this is the initial values of global variables and things like that are in the executable, But we don't want to, write back to the executable if we change global variables. We just want it to stay in our program. So this is how that's typically loaded, is with copy on write. And this means that if you don't modify some global variables that you can modify, well, two copies of bincat are going to use the same one. Save memory. It's a win. And if you don't read them, we don't even have to load them from disk. So how do these work? So the reads happen like we saw before. But we have to do something special on the write. So what we're going to do is that everything that goes to the cache data for the file, we're not going to let that be writable. Before we allow you to write it, here, we're not going to do that. So if you try to write to something, you'll get a fault because the page table entry is read-only. And when that happens, we're going to make a copy of that particular part of the file just for you and update your page table to point to it. We'll probably still keep around our cache copy of that part of the file because other things might want to read from the file. Yeah?
So this copy isn't part of the cache, right?
So this copy isn't part of the cache of file data. Yes? Other questions? So this is an application of copy and write for something other than fork. So it's just really common in real operating systems. This is a very common thing to do because it comes up all the time in programs. So yeah, here I have it labeled as copies of the file data modified. It's not cache data because we're not going to ever write it back to the file. It's just part of the executable's memory that is allocated to it. So also, I have a mapping for heap. So the way Linux tracks memory that you allocate without a file is it just makes a mapping for it that's not associated with any file. So that's what we've done for the heap here, that there's no file associated with it. You can see the file information's all zeros. And that's just how we indicate that. But we have the same sort of flags because we need to know, well, is this region of memory you have, is it readable and writable or executable? So we track that, and so on. And the way that works is, well, we allocate it on demand. So we'll have some data that's loaded. There's no docking file. And if you try to access something, we'll allocate that space on demand, we'll update your page table, point to new memory. We also do this thing called swapping, which we'll get to later, that sometimes we run out of memory. And you might say, well, we should not do that, but we run out of memory and we want to free up some memory. And one option would be that we could try to free up all this cached file data and so on, but we want to have more options of what we can free up. And one thing we might free up is we might free up some of the program's memory, but we need to put it somewhere. And we don't have a file to put it. With the cached file data, we could just write it back to, we could just like know, oh, it's in bincat, I can read that again. We can't do that with the heap of bincat. So what are we going to do instead is we're going to make a file on disk to store that data. We'll do what's known as swapping it out. So if we need more memory, we'll just save part of this to disk temporarily and mark the page table entry as invalid. If later the program accesses that memory, then we'll mark it as valid and load in the data. So you might say, this seems awfully expensive for the heap. And the trick, the reason why we'll be OK with doing this, is that we'll try really, really hard to be confident that the program is not going to try to access this data again anytime soon. And as long as we're right, this won't be too bad. Now, I showed you swapping for, you know, data with no backing. We also do this swapping procedure for a copy on write data. So here, I have some data that's loaded copy on write. I have a copy of the data, and well, if I want to free up memory, the easiest thing to do is just to get rid of this cache data for the file. Why is that easiest? Because probably it's already on disk. I don't need to do anything. But if we do that, and we still need more memory, we want to free up this copy of that data that's modified. Since it's modified, we can't just copy from the file on disk. So what we'll do is we'll allocate a new file for that data and place it there. And we'll have to look up if the program tries to access it again, to remember to read from here and not from here. So we'll have to track that information. Questions about showed here? So historically, this swapping, this moving the data for a program between memory and disk, was the primary purpose of virtual memory. One way of thinking about it is that you have your memory hierarchy is registers, then cache, then DRAM, main memory, then SSDs or disk. And one way you might view this is that the process is really allocated space on disk, and memory is just a cache for that. And their space on disk has a virtual address, but it doesn't have a physical address unless it's loaded into the cache that is memory. That memory only keeps things which are currently active on disk. It doesn't keep things that are, not. Things that are not currently active are not cached in memory, is the way of thinking about it. But this design pervades sort of POSIX-like OSs, and this is sort of where mmap is located from. And you can think of swapping as if everything is mmapped to a file, but we just have a default file if you didn't specify one. Like, it's kind of the same idea. Like, with mmap for reading and writing a file, we keep it cached some of the time, but we have a place to put it if we run out of space. So you can think of the swapping we're doing as just, we have a place to put all the things that don't have a file name if we run out of space. So it's one way of viewing swapping. And it is something that Unix-like OSs generally do. Now, swapping these days is a lot less attractive than it was in the 60s or 70s when people were designing virtual memory systems. And the big reason is that hard disks and even SSDs are kind of slow. So hard drives take milliseconds to tens of milliseconds to do writes. You also have a minimum size to do reads and writes of like 512 bytes. This is part of why pages are not really tiny. Because if you want to work with hard drives, you want to write more than 512 bytes. And even SSDs, they're a ton faster than hard drives, but they're still microseconds. And a typical memory access is like nanoseconds, effectively. But the typical design of virtual memory systems and operating systems is based on the idea of treating memory as a cache for disk, even though, because of the performance, we don't really want to actually have things on disk all the time. And this is known as the page cache. The idea is that the pages we have in memory are a cache for what's on disk. That's what we're managing them as. Everything has a place on disk. So memory is a cache for disk, and every file and every piece of program memory has a place on disk, and that's the permanent home. That's the fallback home. That's where we know we can always fit it. But we keep a copy in memory, and we try to have it in memory most of the time because that's where it's fast. Just like for a processor cache, we keep a copy in the cache as much as we possible, because that's where it's fast. So our physical memory pages are just stuff that really is on disk, conceptually being kept around and manipulated in faster temporary storage. Now, with a modern system with lots of memory, that temporarily might be as long as the data is valid, but that's fine. And we're going to talk about, well, given that we have this cache, how do we manage it intelligently? We're going to talk about lots of strategies for that. And you might say, well, since we don't actually want to have lots of swapping going on, maybe this isn't useful. But the reason it's useful is because we use this for files. So we keep parts of files in this. And this is where it really comes in on modern systems, is that when you read and write files, you're usually reading and writing memory, not disk. And we really want that to be the case, because boy, does that make your programs faster. If you are running some game which is loading a million image files, that's sure going to be a lot faster if it's reading them from memory and not disk. And that's going to be most of the advantage, but this is also going to include all the program data. But usually with the program data, our hope is that managing it intelligently means it doesn't ever go to disk, at least most of the time. But let's think about how this cache works. So this might be less useful for those of you who did not intensively study caches in a prereq to this course. But our cache block, in this case, is a physical page. That's what we can load from the disk into memory, and load from memory into the disk. We have to deal with physical pages, because that's all we can store in page tables, and we're kind of restricted on that for what programs can use. It's fully associative. Any virtual address or part of a file can be stored anywhere in memory. We have no restrictions. For a virtual address, we just set the page table entry. For a part of a file, we have some struct in the kernel that represents the file. We can put a pointer to anything in it. So you can put any data anywhere. And unlike our processor cache, we can manage this in the OS. So this is not something that's going to be managed by the hardware. The OS is going to decide what goes in the cache, what gets replaced if I run out of space, what do I get rid of. So replacement is going to be managed by the OS, but cache hits aren't, and that's good because a cache hit is every single memory access in your program. And boy, oh boy, it would be bad if we had to do a system call every time you push something on the stack. So those happen without the OS, and the way they happen is that the processor uses the page table. So questions on this idea, the page cache. So let's take a look at our components of our page cache. So we have two types of things our page cache stores. So we store pages of files that we can access with read or write, and we store stuff that is mapped to a program's memory with a virtual address. And for both of these, we have to have some way of taking a virtual address or a file name and locate an offset, and determining where on disk is that. Why do we need that? Because we need to load it. We also have some way of taking it, a virtual address, and mapping it to a physical page. And also, we're going to find out we're going to need some other mappings. So let's go start going through these. So most obvious, based on what we've been talking about recently, is that if we have a virtual address for a program and a cache hit, the page table tells us where it is. We also need to have some data structure, what I call read or write, that looks up where is the cache part of this file. And this is not optional because of that mmap to write files thing. That if I write a file with mmap and then I call read, I expect to see what I wrote. So I have to read from the cache. So to implement this on the read side, the OS is just going to keep track however it wants. It can use a hash table or whatever, where the cache parts of the file are. for the virtual addresses, the OS has to set up a page table because that's what the hardware is going to use when the program does memory accesses. Okay. So that. So let's talk about this, how this mapping works in Linux, and then we'll talk about some other things. So you might think, okay, we don't need to, we need to look up where cache data is. So this is what the OS tracks where data goes. So we have our forward case where we're accessing our page table. That just uses the page table directly. This is when we access a virtual address. For reads or writes, it's more complicated how we find the data. So in Linux, this is our process control block. We have to look up a file descriptor. In our file descriptor, we have to look up what file does it refer to. And Linux stores that as a struct inode. We'll see the name inode when we talk about file systems a whole lot and talk about what that means. And inside that is a structure called address space, which is basically a balanced tree of the cache pages for the file. So it does this whole lookup to find cache versions of the file on read or write. Now, we also need this information for, we also need to do the same type of lookup for accesses when something isn't in the page table yet. So we need to fill the page table, and we need to do that based on this information about the cached pages for a file. So the way that works in Linux is that we have that table I showed you as the list of mappings, which is stored as this thing called VM area struct. So there's just a list of those, and they just say, this address X to Y is from this file. And they have a pointer to the file as an open file, which points to an inode, which points to that address space struct. So when a page fault happens, the OS checks, hey, what mmap is it from? What call of the mmap happened? And it looks up the file to find the cache page to fill in that page table entry the first time. Okay, so questions about this? Sorry, I have a little fumbly. This is for filling of regions. Now, this brings up that there are multiple types of page faults we have here that we've seen. So there's one case where we can have a page fault because we haven't filled the page table yet. But when we do this lookup, we say, oh, yep, that's actually in there. It's in the in memory. I just set the page table entry and return. This is called, in Linux and many other OSs, a minor page fault. So there's lots of page faults like this. There's also major page faults. That's where I do this lookup, and I look for the cache page here, and I say, oh, it's not there. I need to load it. And that's called a major page fault. And we can, in fact, get information about this. So if I run some arbitrary command with the time utility, it can show me things about memory usage, including page faults. And it find out that when I ran this program, there were only minor page faults. Why did this happen? Because I had run this program just before, and everything it was using was cached. So, mentioned that we had this cache struct. So on Linux, like to be really concrete, this is what partial declaration of the struct address space. So they have this structure, which has, they call it a radix tree root. So it's actually a balanced tree of some sort, not a binary tree, but a balanced tree of cache pages, which is exactly this blue thing on that picture. So that's the forward part. So we have another thing, which is what happens on a cache miss. So on a cache miss, for either reading or writing, the OS has to look up the location on the disk and then bring the thing into cache, and then we do the other direction. The case with either the page table or the OS data structure of cache pages to find the data after we bring it in. So to do this, we need to have our tracking of locations on disk. So these two data structures. So for the disk location, this is going to be based on the file system, which we'll talk about a whole lot later. For virtual addresses, there's two options. So one option is it's part of a file. Like it's actually data that's cached part of the file, or is this same as the file on disk. In that case, we point to the file and use the same mechanism we'd use for a file. But the other option is that it's swapped out part of a file. We need to track that somehow. So Linux and many other OSs use this trick of storing it in the page table entry. So remember how when we looked at the page table entry format, it said for a invalid or not present page table entry, the format was 0 for the present bit, and everything else was ignored. Well, it's ignored by the processor. That means the OS can use it. And that's what Linux chooses to do. It just puts the information about the location on disk in there. So we have this list of memory regions, and I can show you like what that struct looks like. We have this struct we saw here. So it points to the file, and also we need to say where in the file is it, because we have an offset that it starts at. Okay. So there's some other pieces we need that need some extra pieces to this data structure. So one thing is that when we're handling a cache miss, we need to allocate a new page to put the data in. And to do this, we want to make it work well as a cache. So we can't just choose randomly. So we want to find something that's not recently used. So in Linux, the way they do this is that they have a struct for every single physical page. So this is a lot of stuff that keeps a linked list of all the pages. So each page is on, there's this linked list of these ordered by how recently they're used, roughly. And we just take the first thing off that list and use it for our new thing we're loading. Now, a problem with this is that when we're doing that, this page that we found, it might be used for something, right? Just because, you know, because we're using all our memory for something, probably. And the concern is maybe it's used for something where we have to take care of getting rid of it. And there's two issues here. So one issue is that we have to update our data structure about cached parts of files to say, hey, this isn't cached anymore. A trickier issue is we have to update page tables. Because if we choose to get rid of something that's in a page table, well, our guess is that the program isn't going to access it soon. But if it does access it, and we don't update the page table, all of a sudden, instead of reading that other thing you had in your memory, you're reading whatever was just allocated. That'd be really bad, right? You don't expect to have your memory randomly change just because you weren't using it for a while. So we need to update all the page tables. And a problem is that when we're doing this, we just learn what the page is. We don't know where it is, so we're going to need an additional data structure to go from a page to both what page tables it's in and what files it's in order to update those data structures. So we're going to need this reverse mapping. Because when we evict a page, we need to remove it from the page tables. So another thing that Linux needs to do, and that all operating systems need to do, is they need to have some way of doing this reverse lookup. And this is often pretty complicated, partly because there's a lot of cases, partly because they want to not like store a whole bunch of extra data for every page because, well, that's a lot. You know, how much bookkeeping do you want to do for every 4 kilobytes of memory? So the way Linux does this has a lot of indirection. So there's, as I said, a structure for every physical page, which you can look up in an array by page number. When you look that up, you get a pointer to the address space for it, if it's part of a file, and that has pointers to all the, via a linked list, to all the mmaps of that file, which we need just to handle this eviction thing. That what if we're getting rid of a cache page? We need to find all the mmaps that use it. And then from the mmaps, we need to find the page table entries that corresponds to and update that particular page table entry. So this is very indirect, but the purpose is to go from this page to a particular page table entry. And we do this indirectly because we don't want to store a list of page table entries for every single 4K, we want something more compact. And this ends up being a little more compact and easier to manage, kind of. Now, a trickier thing is we also need to do this for swapped out stuff that doesn't belong to a file. Or not swapped out, but part like memory, like heap. Heap doesn't have a file, so Linux has like a substitute for a file called a non-VMA, which only exists to store a list of things that are sharing the same heap memory or other type of like non-file memory. You might say, why would things be shared? Can someone think of a reason? Hint, it has to do with your next assignment. Why would some memory that's not part of a file be shared between two programs? Yeah. Yeah, so if we call fork, they're going to be shared. So they track, including handling fork, and keeping track of that. So there's this list of who shares this data, which points, again, to the page table eventually. This also makes it easier to manage forks, because when you fork a program in this scheme, what they do is they modify this to add another process to the list, rather than another mmap region to the list, rather than having to update every single page you made read-only in the data structure. So, you know, they don't do a separate list for each page, they just track them in these memory regions. Okay, so we're going to talk a lot about page replacement. So I talked about one thing we need to do for page replacement is we need to find all the page tables to update and all the list of cache file pages to update. And we also have to do the rest. So we evict a page and so on. Evict a page to do it. So we're going to talk a lot about how do we evict a page. And the tricky part is not the eviction, though the eviction like has lots of intricate steps with find all the page table entries that refer to it, mark it as invalid. But the tricky part is, how do we track what's used? And that's what we're going to spend most of our time on. How do I know what's a good thing to use? Because even though I'm going to do all the bookkeeping to handle what if I evict something that the program was actually using and make the program behave correctly, it's going to behave really slowly if it actually uses it. So we have correct behavior, but to be fast, we want to have good choices for what we evict. I want to talk about different goals then. So kind of like with scheduling, we're going to have different ways we can measure how good are we at choosing pages. And we have a couple here. So one is hit rate. Minimize the number of misses. Misses meaning minimize the number of times I have a page fault and it's not in memory. Another goal would be maximize performance. You might say, isn't that the same thing as minimizing the number of misses? Well, kind of. But not all misses are the same. For example, creating a page of all zeros versus reading something from disk, those might both be misses in the sense we don't have something cached and need to actually allocate it, but one's probably a lot more expensive than the other. If we have to write stuff back to disk before we reuse that page, that's a lot more expensive than if we can just discard data that we know is already on disk. Also, it turns out that disk really wants us to read multiple pages at a time. That's much faster when using a disk or an SSD, so we want to do that, and we'd be better off like loading a bunch of things at once, even if that's more misses. So that's another thing. So another goal we might have is fairness, because share of memory, where every user gets its full, some share of memory. And that means that we don't care about hit rate so much as that every user gets the same performance or something like that. And that would have very different strategies. Like we saw with scheduling, it's very different when we cared about throughput versus treating all the users the same. Now, you might say, okay, so in order to optimize hit rate, what you're going to do is you're just going to choose the thing that's least likely to be used in the future. And that's approximately what. But there's actually more options than that. So you could actually be proactive. So you can read stuff that the program doesn't request. And this is actually a thing OSs do. We'll get back to it later. But for now, we're going to start with a simpler case of saying, let's assume that we only bring stuff in on demand, as late as possible. We don't try to guess what the program's going to do other than when the program tries to do an access. That's the only time we act. We don't act otherwise. And we only want to maximize hits. We don't care that some misses are more expensive than others. So then there's a concrete answer for what is the best possible algorithm. So under these restrictions, we aren't being proactive. We aren't going to say, I think you're going to read this in the future, so I'll bring it in before you access it. But the best possible algorithm is called Velleity's Min. And the algorithm is whenever you need to bring in a page, you replace the thing that's going to be accessed furthest in the future. Now, there's a little problem, which is that we can't actually do this. And the reason we can't actually do this is that figuring out what the program's going to access furthest in the future is information the operating system definitely doesn't have. Right? You'd have to know what are all the loads the rows and stores the program's going to run to figure that out. And we don't know that. So we'll talk about things we can actually do later, but this is useful as a point of comparison. Like, how close are we to the best? So let's walk through how this works. So let's say here I have three physical pages to store my data of any sort, and I'm listing what virtual memory is being accessed. And I just labeled it A, B, C, and D. This could represent files, could represent parts of the program's heap. Doesn't really matter. So now, so initially, I just read A, B, and C, and I have free empty space. I load them in. Now I access D. What should I replace? A, B, or C? Yeah, C. And the answer is C because that's furthest in the future. We access A one time step in the future, C two time step, three time steps in the future, and C the most. So we replace C. So then I keep going, and now when I access C, it turns out that that's going to be what I'm going to have to replace something for. So what should I replace here to bring in C? So A or D. So we know A or D, according to this, aren't accessed again, but B is, so we'll replace one of them. I just arbitrarily chose A. Both of them are accessed infinitely far in the future, and so on. Okay, so we all can finish this off. So we'll start with that first one and then keep going. So what does D replace?
C.
And if it does that, then it turns out that we don't have any misses until we access C. And then what does C replace? B. And then we don't have any more misses. So this minimizes our misses. Great. It's the best thing we can do, except that we can't do it, because we can't predict the future perfectly. So since we can't do that, we're going to have to look for patterns instead. And fortunately, program behavior is kind of predictable in this sense. And the main idea we're going to have is this idea of a working set. That at any time, there's some subset of a program's memory that it cares about. And you can think of this as like, there's some functions we're using, there are local variables, there are arrays and data structures. Like, we can specify some part of the program that is actually active, and we'll call this the working set. And the rest of memory of the program is basically inactive. Until, of course, the program switches to doing something else, in which case it switches working sets. And if we think of it, this program as having these working sets, our goal when doing page replacement is to make sure each program has its working set and not give it anything else. We don't want to give it anything else because it doesn't need it. We want to make sure it has its working set because we know it uses it. So our replacement policy based on this is figure out what the working set is and replace anything that's not in it. Now, we can't precisely figure out the working set probably, but the approximation is everything that the program has recently used, probably part of its current working set. This is an approximation. It's not always going to be true, especially if the program's switching from doing one thing to doing another. But this is going to be the intuition for our replacement policy. So, questions on this idea? Now, there's good actual empirical evidence that programs have real working sets. So here are some graphs of processor cache size versus miss rate, and we can see we have these like plateaus where increasing the cache size doesn't increase the miss rate. And this is probably means that the working set, the memory the program actually cares about, was equal to that cache size before it plateaued, and adding more stuff to the cache didn't help. And our goal with our page cache is that we want to give the program the memory for the working set, but we don't want to bother with the rest. And the way we're going to approximate that is just use what's done recently. So our practical policy that's based on this working set assumption is going to be, if you think of caches, just being temporal locality, that things accessed now will be accessed again soon. That's our assumption, and we know that's true because of this working set idea for how programs behave. So this gives us two policies we can actually implement. So one's least recently used, and the other is least frequently used under, like, in some time slice. We'll talk about least recently used. So with least recently used, you just figure out all the accesses, and you take the page which has been accessed least recently. Now, accessed doesn't mean that you got a page fault for it, because, well, when the program has its memory in the cache, it's in its page table, there's no page faults. So let's think about what happens for least recently used. So here, what should be replaced for least recently used? C, because if we look, we're accessing D, B was used most recently, then A, then C. So we replace D, because A, two time units, B, one, C, three, even though C was loaded most recently. Then when we access A, it's a hit, and D is a hit, and it works out pretty good until we access C again. Now, what is C going to replace? A, because if we say we just used B, before that we used D, so A is the least recently used thing, and so on. So questions about this? So this is a case where LRU does a good job, but it's not guaranteed. It's not the optimal policy, and there are some cases where it does really badly. So this is LRU if I'm doing ABCD, ABCD, ABCD. And this is what the min policy is. So we're doing 8 replacements versus 3. 8 misses versus 3. Or 6, I guess, replacements. So this is 8 misses. This is because the first axis is our misses. So this is equals 11 misses, and this is 6 misses. But of course, how could we have known that this would happen? Well, in this case, actually, you could have a pretty good hypothesis how we could have guessed what's going to happen. But if we're using an LRU policy, we wouldn't make that guess. Questions about this? Yeah.
So how would LRU work with multi-threading? And so, like, in this case, like, if you were using, like, different resources, like, one could say that, like, you're using one resource, then another resource, then another resource.
So the question is, how do we tell what the order of accesses is, especially when we have multiple threads? So it turns out, even when we have one thread, this is a challenge. And our solution is, we're going to approximate it. It's going to be way too expensive to get the actual order of accesses, even with just one core and one thread. Okay, so let's just do a quick exercise. I guess we can probably go through this quickly. So I'm going to load. So I guess to start out, we load A, B, and D. Then what does B. So you're saying B gets replaced because D is used one time unit ago, A2, C, B3. So replace C. B. Now what is
A?
Now A is the least recently used. Now this is a hit. And that's a hit, this is a hit, and so on. And then what do we replace A with? Replace B, because B is the least recently used. Okay. So hopefully you can all go through that. Okay, so I told you that we have LRU, and it seems like, okay, LRU, you know, it's a nice policy. It seems pretty simple to figure out what happens. But problematically, the question is, how do we implement it? So there's an easy way of doing it. The inline software, you maintain a doubly linked list of pages. When a page is accessed, you remove it from the linked list where it is and add it to the head. When you replace it, you take from the tail and evict it, remove it from all the page tables, do all that work to make sure that no one can access it because you're putting something else there. Now, a big problem here is we need to make an update every time you access a page. And you might say, oh, but we have page faults to handle things. But remember, page faults are for just setting the page table entry initially. Most accesses aren't going to have a page fault. But if we want to run code every time it's accessed, the only mechanism the OS seems to have is make every access a page fault. That's really expensive. Really, really expensive. So, like, we need to make every page invalid. Then we need to, like, single step one instruction. We could absolutely do this, and it would be horribly slow. We'd be, like, running 100 instructions for every instruction. Horribly, horribly slow. So, what can we actually do? So, the solution is we're not going to implement LRU. It's too hard. So instead, we're going to ask the question, not actual LRU, we're going to approximate it. And this is actually pretty simple, and it makes sense if we think about our working set model. In our working set model, all the stuff that's part of working sets should have been accessed very recently. And everything that's not part of working sets probably hasn't been accessed for a while. And if it's not in a working set, we really don't actually care which one we choose. We don't actually care about getting the least recently used one. We just want to get something that's probably not in a working set. And another reason we don't care is that we know that, well, least recently used isn't actually optimal. The optimal policy was that crystal ball, look into the future policy. So even if we were approximating LRU, we might not be getting any loss in miss rate from that. Like, it could do just as well because we know LRU isn't optimal. So what we're going to look for is not, is this the least recently accessed thing, just has it not been accessed recently? Like, just, you know, it doesn't matter. We don't care about distinguishing between all the things which haven't been accessed for a while. We just want any one of them. And if we're doing this, we can detect accesses in a coarser grained way. So one option is we can say, we're not going to detect every access, but I just want to check, was this page accessed in the last few seconds? So one way I can do that is if I planned ahead a few seconds ago and marked the page as invalid, I can wait for a page fault. If a page fault happens, yes, it was accessed in the last few seconds. If it doesn't, no, it wasn't. And yes, we're relying on having page faults to detect these accesses, which is going to have a cost, but we're only doing this once every few seconds, which is way, way cheaper than that full LRU proposal where we're doing it for every single instruction. And if once every few seconds is too often, we can do it less often. We can do it once every minute, once every hour. So this is our practical approach. Also, it's pretty common for hardware to actually help us out here. So hardware often has an accessed or reference bit in the page table. In fact, x86 has this. And the way this works is the hardware sets it to 1 if it's not already set to 1 on an access. So if you want to see if it was accessed in the last few seconds, you set the access bit to 0 a few seconds ago, then you see if it becomes 1. And this is pretty fast for the hardware to do because the hardware doesn't update the page table except on the first access, which takes it from 0 to 1. But we can also do this manually, so this doesn't need hardware support. And just set it, you know, make a page fault happen and change our own data structure. But the key idea is that we don't detect every access, we just need to say there was an access in this time window. And that's the information we're going to use. So we can either just say, mark the page, page is invalid, we get a page fault, and the OS says, okay, I saw a page fault at time X, I'm gonna record that and use that later on when I need to do page replacement. And also update it to present, because now I got my sample of accesses in my time window. But we just don't see any of the other accesses when we do that. But when we want to detect more accesses, we can do that. We just clear the present bit and look for another page fault. So we just do this periodically, and we can get an idea about what's the rough rate of access. And often the processor will do this, and it's the same idea. So we have an access bit set to 0. It sets it to 1 on a read and keeps it at 1. And when the OS wants to look for, to see, has it been accessed recently, before, when it wants to start looking for accesses, it resets the access bit after recording whether it was 1 or 0. And then if it's accessed again, it becomes 1. And we can see, yep, it was accessed since I reset it. Okay. Questions about this? Now, there's a subtlety about this, and I just showed this for one program. But let's say we have multiple copies of bincat accessing the executable. We said that we're going to have a cache copy of the file, executable file, and it's going to be accessed by multiple programs. This means that when we're doing this checking, a subtlety is that we need to find all of the access bits. In order to know whether it was used. So this is another reason why we went to have a mapping from physical pages to page table entries. Because we don't just want to check one process's page. We want to check for this page, has it been accessed by any of the processes which might have a copy of it in their memory. So, questions about this? Access bits? So, that's for checking if something has been read or written, just accessed at all for our replacement policies. When we were talking about doing swapping earlier, we had another thing we needed to check for, which was, we mentioned I could mmap a file to write to it, and I said I write to the file, I modify the cache copy of the file, but eventually we might have to write it back to the file on disk. Now, one option would be, we could say, okay, whenever we get rid of a cache copy of the file, we update the file with whatever's in that cache copy. But this would mean that we write to disk a whole lot when we don't really need to, right? For bincat, executable, we aren't modifying bincat all the time. So instead, we want to track, well, what actually wrote to it. And we want to do this on a page granularity. So there's something called a dirty bit, which is the name for tracking whether a particular page has been written to. And just like with access bits, we can do this with software only or with help from the hardware. With software, what we do to detect that write is we initially mark the page as read-only, and when a write happens, we don't copy the data, we just say, okay, we mark it as writable, but note that it's been modified. And we only need to do that once, because we know we're just going to write out whatever the last version of it was when we get rid of it from our memory. The hardware will also do it for us, just like with the access bit, except rather than changing it on every access, it'll just change it on writes. And we have the same issue that we have to check all the programs which might have written to it for the dirty bit. So these are both things that x86 has in their page table entry. So this is the DNA bit I showed you earlier, are precisely those two bits. So I've told you about how we track information about when pages are used. So the question is, how do we use this sort of mechanism to produce actual policies we can implement? And that's what we'll get to next time.